She felt him get hard against the nape of her neck, and she kept stroking his leg in a gentle, continuous rhythm, moving closer and closer toward the soft part of his inner thigh. When Michael could stand it no longer, he scooped her up in one abrupt motion and carried her into the bedroom. After a frenzied session of lovemaking, Michael got out of bed and headed for the shower. Astrid lay on his side of the bed, deliriously spent. Reunion sex was always the best. Her iPhone let out a soft ping. Who could be texting her at this hour? She reached for the phone, squinting at the bright glare of the text message. It read, "Miss you inside me." "Makes no sense at all. Who sent me this?" Astrid wondered, gazing in half amusement at the unfamiliar number. It looked like a Hong Kong number. Was this one of Eddie's pranks? She peered at the text message again, realizing, all of a sudden, that she was holding her husband's phone. Chapter 10. Edison Chang, Shanghai. It was the mirror in the closet that did it. The closet in Liu Ming's brand new triplex penthouse in the Huangpu district really put Eddie over the edge. Ever since Shanghai became Asia's party capital, Liu had been spending more time here with his latest mistress, a Beijing-born starlet whose contract he had to buy over from a Chinese film company at the cost of $19 million, $1 million for every year of her life. Liu and Eddie had flown up for the day to inspect Liu's new super luxe apartment, and they were standing in a hangar-like 2,000-square-foot closet that boasted an entire wall of floor-to-ceiling windows, Macassar ebony cupboards, and banks of mirrored doors that parted automatically to reveal cedar-lined suit racks. "It's all climate-controlled," Liu noted. "The closets on this end are maintained at 55 degrees specifically for my Italian cashmere, houndstooth, and fur. But the shoe display cabinets are kept at 70 degrees, which is optimal for leather, and the humidity is regulated to a constant 35%, so my Belutis and Cortes never break a sweat. You gotta treat those babies right, eh, Ma?" Eddie nodded, thinking that it was time to redo his own closet. "Now let me show you the piece de resistance," Liu said, pronouncing pièce like piece. With a flourish, he glided his thumb over a mirrored panel, and its surface instantly transformed into a high-definition screen that projected the life-size image of a male model in a double-breasted suit. Above his right shoulder hovered the brand names of each item of clothing, followed by the dates and locations where the outfit was previously worn. Liu waved a finger in front of the screen as if he were flicking a page, and the man now appeared in corduroy pants and a cable-knit sweater. "There's a camera embedded in this mirror that takes a picture of you and stores it, so you can see every single thing you've ever worn, organized by date and place. This way, you'll never repeat an outfit." Eddie stared at the mirror in amazement. "Oh, I've seen that before," he said rather unconvincingly as the envy began to course through his veins. He felt the sudden urge to shove his friend's bloated face into the pristine mirrored wall. Once again, Liu was showing off another shiny new toy he did fuck all to deserve. It had been like this since they were little. When Liu turned 7, his father gave him a titanium bicycle custom designed for his pudgy frame by former NASA engineers. It was stolen within 3 days. At 16, when Liu aspired to become a Canto hip-hop singer, his father built him a state-of-the-art recording studio and bankrolled his first album. The CD can still be found on eBay. Then, in 1999, he funded Liu's internet startup, which managed to lose more than $90 million and go belly up at the height of the internet boom. And now this, the latest in a countless collection of homes around the globe, showered upon him by his adoring father. Yes, Liu Ming, charter member of Hong Kong's Lucky Sperm Club, got everything handed to him on a diamond-encrusted platter. It was just Eddie's shitty luck to have been born to parents who never gave him a cent. In what is arguably the most materialistic city on Earth, a city where the key mantra is prestige, The tongue waggers within Hong Kong's most prestigious chattering circles would agree that Edison Chang lived a life to be envied. They would acknowledge that Eddie was born into a prestigious family, even though his Chang lineage was frankly a bit common. Had attended all the prestigious schools, nothing tops Cambridge, well, except Oxford, and now worked for Hong Kong's most prestigious investment bank, though it was a pity he didn't follow in his father's footsteps and become a doctor. At 36, Eddie still retained his boyish features, getting a bit plump, but never mind, it made him look more prosperous. Had chosen well by marrying pretty Fiona Tung, Hong Kong old money, but what a shame about that stock manipulation scandal her father had gotten into with Tato Tai To Lui. And his children, Constantine, Augustine, and Callista, were always so well-dressed and well-behaved. But that younger son, was he a bit autistic or something? Edison and Fiona lived in the duplex penthouse of Triumph Towers, one of the most sought-after buildings high on Victoria Peak. 5 bedrooms, 6 baths, more than 4,000 square feet, not including the 800-square-foot terrace, where they employed 2 Filipino and 2 mainland Chinese maids. The Chinese were better at cleaning, while the Filipinos were great with the kids. Their Biedermeier-filled apartment, decorated by the celebrated Hong Kong-based Austro-German decorator Caspar von Morgenlatte to evoke a Habsburg hunting schloss, had recently been featured in Hong Kong Tattle. Eddie was photographed preening at the bottom of his marble spiral staircase in a forest green Tyrolean jacket, his hair slicked back, while Fiona, sprawled uncomfortably at his feet, wore a claret-colored gown by Oscar de la Renta. In the parking garage of their building, they owned 5 parking spots, valued at $250,000 each, where their fleet consisted of a Bentley Continental GT, Eddie's weekday car, an Aston Martin Vanquish, Eddie's weekend car, a Volvo S40, Fiona's car, a Mercedes S550, the family car, and a Porsche Cayenne, the family sport utility vehicle. At Aberdeen Marina, there was his 64-foot yacht, Kaiser. Then there was the holiday condo in Whistler, British Columbia, the only place to be seen skiing, since there was semi-decent Cantonese food an hour away in Vancouver. Eddie was a member of the Chinese Athletic Association, the Hong Kong Golf Club, the China Club, the Hong Kong Club, the Cricket Club, the Dynasty Club, the American Club, the Jockey Club, the Royal Hong Kong Yacht Club, and too many private dining clubs to recount. Like most upper-crust Hong Kongers, Eddie also possessed what was perhaps the ultimate membership card, Canadian permanent resident cards for his entire family, a safe haven in case the powers that be in Beijing ever pulled a Tiananmen again. He collected watches and now possessed more than 70 timepieces from the most esteemed watchmakers, all Swiss, of course, except for a few vintage Cartiers, which he installed in a custom-designed bird's-eye maple display console in his private dressing room. His wife did not have her own dressing room. He had made Hong Kong Tattle's most invited list 4 years in a row, and befitting a man of his status, he had already gone through 3 mistresses since marrying Fiona 13 years ago. Despite this embarrassment of riches, Eddie felt extremely deprived compared to most of his friends. He didn't have a house on the peak. He didn't have his own plane. He didn't have a full-time crew for his yacht, which was much too small to host more than 10 guests for brunch comfortably. He didn't have any Rothkos or Pollocks or the other dead American artists one was required to hang on the wall in order to be considered truly rich these days. And unlike Leo, Eddie's parents were the old-fashioned type, insisting from the moment Eddie graduated that he learn to live off his earnings. It was so bloody unfair. His parents were loaded, and his mother was set to inherit another obscene bundle if his Singapore grandmother would ever kick the bucket. Ma had already suffered 2 heart attacks in the past decade, but now she had a defibrillator installed and could go on ticking for God only knows how long. Unfortunately, his parents were also in the pink of health, so by the time they keeled over and the money was split up between himself, his bitchy sister, and his good-for-nothing brother, it wouldn't be nearly enough. Eddie was always trying to guesstimate his parents' net worth, much of which was gleaned from information his real estate friends leaked to him. It became an obsession of his, and he kept a spreadsheet on his home computer, diligently updating it every week based on property valuations and then calculating his potential future share. No matter how he ran the numbers, he realized he would most likely never make Fortune Asia's list of Hong Kong's top 10 richest with the way his parents were handling things. But then his parents were always so selfish. Sure, they raised him and paid for his education and bought him his first apartment, but they failed him when it came to what was truly important. They didn't know how to flaunt their wealth properly. His father, for all his fame and celebrated skill, had grown up middle class with solidly middle class tastes. He was happy enough being the revered doctor, driven around in that shamefully outdated Rolls Royce, wearing that rusty Audemars Piguet watch, and going to his clubs. And then there was his mother. She was so cheap, forever counting her pennies. She could have been one of the queens of society if she would just play up her aristocratic background, wear some designer dresses, or move out of that flat in the mid-levels. That goddamn flat. Eddie hated going over to his parents' place. He hated the lobby with its cheap-looking Mongolian granite floors and the old lady security guard who was forever eating stinky tofu out of a plastic bag. Inside the flat, he hated the peach-colored leather sectional sofa and white lacquered consoles, bought when the old Lane Crawford on Queens Road was having a clearance sale in the mid-1980s, the glass pebbles at the bottom of every vase of fake flowers, the random collection of Chinese calligraphy paintings, all presents from his father's patients clustering the walls, and the medical honors and plaques lined up on the overhead shelf that ran around the perimeter of the living room. He hated walking past his old bedroom, which he had been forced to share with his little brother, with its nautical-themed twin beds and navy blue IKEA wall unit, still there after all these years. Most of all, he hated the large walnut-framed family portrait peeking out from behind the big-screen television, forever taunting him with its smoky brown portrait studio backdrop and the gold-embossed Sammy photo studio in the bottom right corner. He hated how he looked in that photograph. He was 19, just back from his first year at Cambridge, with shoulder-length feathered hair, wearing a Paul Smith tweed blazer he thought was so cool at the time, his elbow arranged jauntily on his mother's shoulder. And how could his mother, born to a family of such exquisite breeding, be completely devoid of taste? Over the years, he had begged her to redecorate or move, but she had refused, claiming that she could never part with all the happy memories of my children growing up here. What happy memories? His only memories were of a childhood spent being too embarrassed to invite any friends over, unless he knew they lived in less prestigious buildings, and teen years spent in the cramped toilet, masturbating practically underneath the bathroom sink with 2 feet against the door at all times. There was no lock. As Eddie stood in Leo's new closet in Shanghai, looking out through the floor-to-ceiling windows at the Pudong Financial District shimmering across the river like Xanadu, he vowed that he would one day have a closet so cool it would make this one look like a fucky little pigsty. Until then, he still had one thing that even Leo's crisp new money could not buy, a thick, embossed invitation to Colin Koo's wedding in Singapore. Chapter 11. Rachel. New York to Singapore. You're kidding, right? Rachel said, thinking Nick was pulling a prank when he steered her onto the plush red carpet of the Singapore Airlines first-class counter at JFK. Nick flashed a conspiratorial grin, relishing her reaction. I figured if you were going to go halfway around the world with me, I should at least try to make it as comfy as possible. But this must have cost a fortune. You didn't have to sell a kidney, did you? No worries. I had about 1 million frequent flyer miles saved up. Still, Rachel couldn't help feeling a little guilty about the millions of frequent flyer points that Nick must have sacrificed for these tickets. Who even flew first class anymore? The second surprise for Rachel came when they boarded the hulking two-story Airbus A380 and were promptly greeted by a beautiful stewardess who looked as if she had materialized straight out of a Soft Focus ad from a travel magazine. Mr. Young, Miss Chu, welcome aboard. Please allow me to show you to your suite. The stewardess sashayed down the aisle in an elegant, figure-hugging, long dress, the famous Singapore Airlines uniform designed by Pierre Balmain, inspired by traditional Malay kebaya. She ushered them to the front section of the plane, which consisted of 12 private suites. Rachel felt as if she was entering the screening room of a luxurious Tribeca loft. The cabin consisted of two of the widest armchairs she had ever seen, upholstered in buttery, hand-stitched poltrona frau leather. Two huge flat-screen televisions placed side by side, and a full-length wardrobe ingeniously hidden behind a sliding, burled walnut panel. A Givenchy cashmere throw was artfully draped over the seats, beckoning them to snuggle up and get cozy. The stewardess gestured to the cocktails awaiting them on the center console. "An aperitif before takeoff? Mr. Young, your usual gin and tonic. Miss Chu, a Kir Royale to get you settled in." She handed Rachel a long-stemmed glass with chilled bubbly that looked like it had been poured just seconds ago. Of course, they would already know her favorite cocktail. "Would you like to enjoy your lounge chairs until dinner, or would you prefer us to convert your suite into a bedroom right after takeoff?" "I think we'll enjoy this screening room setup for a while," Nick replied. As soon as the stewardess was out of earshot, Rachel declared, "Sweet Jesus, I've lived in apartments smaller than this." "I hope you don't mind roughing it. This is all rather lowbrow by Asian hospitality standards," Nick teased. "I think I can make do." Rachel curled up on her sumptuous armchair and began fiddling with her remote control. "Okay, there are more channels than I can count. Are you going to watch one of your bleak Swedish crime thrillers?" "Oof, The English Patient. I want to see that." "Wait a minute. Is it bad to watch a film about a plane crash while you're flying?" "That was a tiny single-engine plane, and wasn't it shot down by Nazis?" "I think it should be just fine," Nick said, placing his hand over hers. The enormous plane began to taxi toward the runway, and Rachel looked out the window at the planes lined up on the tarmac, lights flashing on the tips of their wings, each one awaiting their turn to hurtle skyward. "You know, it's finally sinking in that we're going on this trip. You excited?" "Just a bit. I think sleeping on an actual bed on a plane is probably the most exciting part." "It's all downhill from here, isn't it?" "Definitely. It's all been downhill since the day we met," Rachel said with a wink, entwining her fingers with Nick's. New York City, autumn, 2008. For the record, Rachel Chu did not feel the proverbial lightning bolt strike when she first laid eyes on Nicholas Young in the garden of La Lanterna di Vittorio. Sure, he was terribly good-looking, but she had always been suspicious of good-looking men, especially ones with quasi-British accents. She spent the first few minutes silently sizing him up, wondering what Sylvia had gotten her into this time. When Sylvia Wong Swartz, Rachel's colleague at New York University's Department of Economics, walked into their faculty suite one afternoon and declared, "Rachel, I just spent the morning with your future husband." She dismissed the declaration as another of Sylvia's silly schemes and didn't even bother to look up from her laptop. "No, seriously, I found your future husband. He was at a student governance meeting with me. It's the third time I've met him, and I'm convinced he's the one for you." "So my future husband is a student? Thanks. You know how much I like jailbait." No, he's the brilliant new prof in the history department. He's also the faculty advisor to the history organization." "You know I don't go for professor types, especially from the history department." "Yeah, but this guy's different, I'm telling you. He's the most impressive guy I've met in years. So charming and hot. I would be after him in a second if I wasn't already married." "What's his name? Maybe I already know him. Nicholas Young? He just started this semester a transfer from Oxford." "A Brit?" Rachel looked up, her curiosity piqued. No. Sylvia put her files down and took a seat, inhaling deeply. "Okay, I'm going to tell you something, but before you write him off, promise you'll hear me out." Rachel couldn't wait for the other shoe to drop. What fabulously dysfunctional detail had Sylvia left out? "He's Asian." "Oh, God, Sylvia." Rachel rolled her eyes, turning back to her computer screen. I knew you were going to react like this. Hear me out. This guy is the total package, I swear.
I'm sure, Rachel said, dripping with sarcasm.
He has the most seductive, slightly British accent, and he's a terrific dresser. He had the most perfect jacket on today, rumpled in all the right places.
Not interested, Sylvia.
And he looks a bit like that Japanese actor from those Wong Kar Wai movies.
Is he Japanese or Chinese?
What does it matter? Every single time any Asian guy so much as looks in your direction, you give them the famous Rachel Chu Asian freeze out and they wither away before you give them a chance.
I do not.
Yes, you do. I've seen you do it so many times. Remember that guy we met at Yanira's brunch last weekend? I was perfectly nice to him. You treated him as if he had herpes tattooed on his forehead. Honestly, you are the most self-loathing Asian I've ever met.
What do you mean? I'm not self-loathing at all.
How about you? You're the one who married the white guy.
Mark's not white. He's Jewish. That's basically Asian.
But that's beside the point. At least I dated plenty of Asians in my time.
Well, so have I.
When have you actually ever dated an Asian?
Sylvia arched her eyebrows in surprise.
Sylvia? You have no idea how many Asian guys I've been set up with over the years.
Let's see. There was the MIT quantum physics geek who is more interested in having me as a 24-hour on-call cleaning lady. The Taiwanese frat boy jock with pecs bigger than my chest. The Harvard MBA chuppy who is obsessed with Gordon Gekko. Should I go on?
What's a chuppy?
Oh, come on, Sylvia.
A Chinese yuppie? I'm sure they weren't as bad as you make it sound.
Well, it was bad enough for me to institute a no Asian guys policy about 5 years ago, Rachel insisted.
Sylvia sighed. Let's face it, the real reason you treat Asian men the way you do is because they represent the type of man your family wishes you would bring home, and you are simply rebelling by refusing to date one.
You are so far off base, Rachel laughed, shaking her head.
Either that or growing up as a racial minority in America, you feel that the ultimate act of assimilation is to marry into the dominant race, which is why you only ever date WASPs or Eurotrash.
Have you ever been to Cupertino, where I spent all my teenage years? Because you would see that Asians are the dominant race in Cupertino. Stop projecting your own issues onto me.
Well, take my challenge and try to be colorblind just one more time.
Okay. I'll prove you wrong. How would you like me to present myself to this Oxford Asian charmer?
You don't have to. I already arranged for us to have coffee with him at La Laterna after work, Sylvia said gleefully.
By the time the gruff Estonian waitress at La Laterna came to take Nicholas's drink order, Sylvia was whispering angrily into Rachel's ear,
Hey, are you mute or something? Enough with the Asian freeze-out.
Rachel decided to play along and join in the conversation. But it soon became apparent to her that Nicholas had no idea that this was a setup, and more disturbingly, seemed far more interested in her colleague. He was fascinated by Sylvia's interdisciplinary background and peppered her with questions about how the economics department was organized. Sylvia basked in the glow of his attention, laughing coquettishly and twirling her hair with her fingers as they bantered. Rachel glared at him. Is this dude completely clueless? Doesn't he notice Sylvia's wedding ring? It was only after 20 minutes that Rachel was able to step outside of her long-held prejudices and consider the situation at hand. It was true. In recent years, she hadn't given Asian guys much of a chance. Her mother had even said,
Rachel, I know it's hard for you to relate properly to Asian men, since you never knew your father.
Rachel found this sort of armchair analysis much too simplistic. If only it were that easy. For Rachel, the problem began practically the day she hit puberty. She began to notice a phenomenon that occurred whenever an Asian of the opposite sex entered the room. The Asian male would be perfectly nice and normal to all the other girls, but special treatment would be reserved for her. First, there was the optical scan. The boy would assess her physical attributes in the most blatant way, quantifying every inch of her body by a completely different set of standards than he would use for non-Asian girls. How big were her eyes? Were they double-lidded naturally, or did she have that eyelid surgery? How light was her skin? How straight and glossy was her hair? Did she have good childbirthing hips? Did she have an accent? And how tall was she, really, without heels on? At 5'7", Rachel was on the tall side, and Asian guys would sooner shoot themselves in the groin than date a taller girl. If she happened to pass this initial hurdle, the real test would begin. Her Asian girlfriends all knew this test. They called it the SATs. The Asian male would begin a not-so-covert interrogation focused on the Asian female's social, academic, and talent aptitudes in order to determine whether she was possible wife and bearer of my son's material. This happened while the Asian male not-so-subtly flaunted his own SAT stats, how many generations his family had been in America, what kind of doctors his parents were, how many musical instruments he played, the number of tennis camps he went to, which Ivy League scholarships he turned down, what model BMW, Audi, or Lexus he drove, and the approximate number of years before he became, pick one, chief executive officer, chief financial officer, chief technology officer, chief law partner, or chief surgeon. Rachel had become so accustomed to enduring the SATs that its absence tonight was strangely disconcerting. This guy didn't seem to have the same MO, and he wasn't relentlessly dropping names. It was baffling, and she didn't quite know how to deal with him. He was just enjoying his Irish coffee, soaking in the atmosphere, and being perfectly charming. Sitting in the enclosed garden lit by colorful, whimsically painted lampshades, Rachel gradually began to see, in a whole new light, the person her friend had been so eager for her to meet. She couldn't quite put her finger on it, but there was something curiously exotic about Nicholas Young. For starters, his slightly disheveled canvas jacket, white linen shirt, and faded black jeans were reminiscent of some adventurer just returned from mapping the Western Sahara. Then there was his self-deprecating wit, the sort that all those British-educated boys were so well known for. But underlying all this was a quiet masculinity and a relaxed ease that was proving to be infectious. Rachel found herself being pulled into his conversational orbit, and before she even realized it, they were yakking away like old friends. At a certain point, Sylvia got up from the table and announced that it was high time she went home before her husband starved to death. Rachel and Nick decided to stay for one more drink, which led to another drink, which led to dinner at the bistro around the corner, which led to gelato in Father Demo Square, which led to a walk through Washington Square Park, since Nick insisted on escorting her back to her faculty apartment. He's the perfect gentleman, Rachel thought, as they strolled past the fountain and the blonde dreadlocked guitarist wailing a plaintive ballad. And you're standing here beside me. I love the passing of time, the boy sang plaintively. Isn't this Talking Heads? Nick asked. Listen. Oh my God, it totally is. He's singing This Must Be the Place, Rachel said in surprise. She loved that Nick knew the song well enough to recognize this bastardized version. He's not half bad, Nick said, taking out his wallet and tossing a few dollars into the kid's open guitar case. Rachel noticed that Nick was mouthing along to the song. He's scoring some major bonus points right now, she thought. And then she realized with a start that Sylvia had been right. This guy, who she'd just spent 6 straight hours engrossed in conversation with, who knew all the lyrics to one of her favorite songs, this guy standing here beside her was the first man she could truly imagine as her husband. Chapter 12. The Leongs, Singapore. At last, the golden couple! Mavis Oon proclaimed as Astrid and Michael made their entrance into the Colonial Club's formal dining room, with Michael in his crisp, navy Richard James suit and Astrid in a long flapper-style silk voile dress the color of persimmon. They made an exceedingly striking pair, and the room rippled with the usual hushed excitement from the ladies, who covertly scrutinized Astrid from hair to heels, and the men who gazed at Michael with a mixture of envy and derision. Astrid, why so late? Felicity Leong scolded her daughter as she arrived at the long banquet table by the trophy wall where members of the extended Leong family and their honored guest from Kuala Lumpur, Tan Sri, Gordon Oon, and Puan Sri, Mavis Oon, were already seated. It should, of course, be noted that a Tansri, or Puansri for woman, is the second most senior honorific title in Malaysia, similar to a British duke. A Tansri is usually richer than a Dato, and has likely spent far more time sucking up to the Malay royals for the title.
So sorry. Michael's flight back from China was delayed, Astrid apologized. I hope you didn't wait for us to order. The food always takes ages here.
Astrid, come, come, let me look at you, Mavis commanded.
The imperious lady, who could easily have won an Imelda Marcos look-alike contest with her dramatically rouged cheeks and fat chignon, patted Astrid's face as if she were a little girl and launched into her trademark gushing.
Ayah, you haven't aged one bit since I last saw you. How's little Cassian? When are you going to have another one? Don't wait too long, La. You need a little girl now. You know my 10-year-old granddaughter, Bella, absolutely worships you ever since her last trip to Singapore. She's always saying, Ma, when I grow up, I want to be just like Astrid. I ask why, and she says, because she always dresses like a movie star, and that Michael is such a hunk.
Everyone at the table roared with laughter. Yes, don't we all wish we could have Astrid's clothing budget and Michael's 8-pack, Astrid's brother Alexander quipped. Harry Leong looked up from his menu and, catching sight of Michael, beckoned him over. With his silvery hair and dark tan, Harry was a leonine presence at the head of the table, and as always, Michael approached his father-in-law with no small amount of trepidation. Harry handed him a large padded envelope.
Here's my MacBook Air. There's something wrong with the Wi-Fi connection.
What exactly is the problem? Is it not finding the right networks, or are you having login problems? Michael asked.
Harry had already turned his attention back to the menu.
What? Oh, it just doesn't seem to work anywhere. You're the one who set it up, and I haven't changed any of the settings.
Thank you so much for taking a look at it. Felicity, did I have the rack of lamb here the last time? Is this where they always overcook the meat?
Michael dutifully took the laptop with him, and as he made his way back to his seat at the other end of the table, Astrid's eldest brother, Henry, grabbed him by his jacket sleeve.
Hey, Mike, hate to bother you with this, but can you stop at the house this weekend? There's something wrong with Zachary's Xbox. I hope you can fix it. It's too mafan to send it back to the factory in Japan for repair.
I might have to go away this weekend, but if not, I'll try to stop by, Michael said flatly. Oh, thank you, thank you, Kathleen, Henry's wife, cut in. Zachary has been driving us absolutely crazy without his Xbox. Is Michael good with gadgets or something? Mavis inquired.
Oh, he's an absolute genius, Mavis, a genius. He's the perfect son-in-law to have around. He can fix anything, Harry proclaimed.
Michael smiled uncomfortably as Mavis fixed her gaze on him.
Now, why did I think he was in the army?
Auntie Mavis, Michael used to work for the Ministry of Defense. He helped to program all the high-tech weapon systems, Astrid said.
Yes, the fate of our country's ballistics defense is in Michael's hands. You know, in case we get invaded by the 250 million Muslims surrounding us on all sides, we can put up a fight for about 10 minutes, Alexander chuckled.
Michael tried to hide his grimace and opened up his heavy leather-bound menu. This month's culinary theme was Taste of the Amalfi, and most of the dishes were in Italian.
Vongole.
That was clams, he knew. But what the heck was paccheri alla ravello, and would it have killed them to include an English translation? This was par for the course at one of the island's oldest sporting clubs, a place so pretentious and buttoned up in Edwardian-era tradition that women were not even allowed to peek into the men's bar until 2007. As a teenager, Michael had played soccer every week at the Padang, the immense green field in front of City Hall that was used for all the national parades, and he often stared curiously at the august Victorian structure at the eastern edge of the Padang. From the goalie post, he could see the glittering chandeliers within, the silver dome dishes set on crisp white tablecloths, the waiters in their black tuxedo jackets scurrying around. He would observe the important-looking people enjoying their dinners and wonder who they were. He longed to walk into the club, just once, to be able to look at the soccer field from the other side of those windows. On a dare, He had asked a couple of his friends to sneak into the club with him. They would go one day before soccer, when they were still dressed in their St. Andrew's school uniforms. They could just stroll in casually, as if they were members, and who would stop them from ordering a drink at the bar?
Don't even dream, Tio. Don't you know what this place is? It's the Colonial Club. You either have to be Angmo, or you have to be born into one of those ultra-rich families to get inside, one of his buddies commented. Gordon and I sold our Palau Club memberships because I realized I was only going there to eat the ice kacang dessert, Michael overheard Mavis telling his mother-in-law. What he wouldn't give to be back out on the field with his friends right now. They could play soccer until the sun went down, and then head to the nearest Kopitiam for cold beers and some nasi goreng fried rice or char bihun noodles. It would be so much better sitting in a coffee shop than here in this Thai that choked him half to death, eating unpronounceable food that was insanely overpriced. Not that anyone at this table ever noticed the prices. The Uns owned practically half of Malaysia, and as for Astrid and her brothers, Michael had never once witnessed any of them pick up a dinner check. They were all adults with children of their own, but Papa Leong always signed for everything. In the Teo family, none of his brothers or sisters would even consider letting their parents pick up the check. How long would this dinner take? They were eating European style, so it would be four courses, and here, that meant one course per hour. Michael stared at his menu again. Ganina! He cursed under his breath. There was some stupid salad course. Who ever heard of serving salad after the main course? This meant five courses, because Mavis liked her desserts, even though all she ever did was complain about her gout. And then his mother-in-law would complain about her heel spurs, and the ladies would volley chronic health complaints back and forth, trying to outdo each other. Then it would be time for the toasts, those long-winded toasts, where his father-in-law would toast the Uns for their brilliance in having been born into the right family. And then Gordon Un would turn around and toast the Leongs for their genius in having been born into the right family as well. And then Henry Leong Jr. would make a toast to Gordon's son, Gordon Jr., the wonderful chap who was caught with the 15-year-old schoolgirl in Langkawi last year. It would be a miracle if dinner ended before 11:30. Astrid glanced across the table at her husband. That ramrod straight posture and tense half-smile he was forcing himself to make as he spoke to Bishop Si Bai Sin's wife was a look she knew well. She had seen it the first time they were invited to tea at her grandmother's, and when they had dinner with the president at Istana, the official residence of the president. Michael clearly wished he were somewhere else right now. Or was it with someone else? Who was that someone else? Since the night she had discovered that text message, she couldn't stop asking herself these questions. Miss You Inside Me. For the first few days, Astrid tried to convince herself that there must be some rational explanation. It was an innocent mistake, a text to the wrong number, some sort of prank or private joke she didn't understand. The text message had been erased by the next morning, and she wished it could just as simply be erased from her mind. But her mind would not let it go. Her life could not go on until she solved the mystery behind these words. She began calling Michael at work every day at odd times, inventing some silly question or excuse to make sure he was where he said he would be. She started checking his cell phone at every fleeting opportunity, feverishly scrolling through all the text messages in the precious few minutes that he was away from his phone. There were no more incriminating text messages. Was he covering his tracks? Or was she just being paranoid? For weeks now, she had been deconstructing every look, every word, every move of Michael's, searching for some sign, some evidence to confirm what she could not bring herself to put into words. But there had been nothing. Everything was seemingly normal in their beautiful life. Until this afternoon. Michael had just returned from the airport, and when he complained of being sore from cramming into a middle seat in the last non-reclining row of an older China Eastern Airlines plane, Astrid suggested that he take a warm soak in the tub with Epsom salts. While he was out of commission, Astrid went snooping through his luggage, aimlessly looking for something, anything. Rifling through his wallet,
She came upon a folded piece of paper hidden underneath the plastic flap that held a Singapore identity card. It was a receipt for dinner from the night before. A receipt from Petrus for 3,812 Hong Kong dollars. Pretty much the price of dinner for two. What was her husband doing having dinner at Hong Kong's fanciest French restaurant when he was supposed to be working on some cloud sourcing project in Chongqing in southwest China? And especially this restaurant, the sort of place he normally would have been dragged to kicking and screaming. There was no way his cash-strapped partners would approve this sort of expense, even for their top clients. And besides, no Chinese clients would ever want to eat French nouvelle cuisine if they could possibly help it. Astrid looked at the receipt for a long time, staring at the bold strokes of his dark blue signature against the crisp white paper. He had signed it with the Carandash fountain pen she had given him on his last birthday. Her heart was beating so fast it felt like it was going to jump out of her chest. And yet, she felt completely paralyzed. She imagined Michael sitting in the candlelit room, perched atop the Island Shangri-La Hotel, staring out at the sparkling lights of Victoria Harbor, enjoying a romantic dinner with the girl who had sent the text message. They started off with a splendid burgundy from the Côte d'Or and finished with the warm, bitter chocolate souffle for two with frosted lemon cream. She wanted to burst into the bathroom and hold the receipt in his face while he was soaking in the tub. She wanted to scream and claw at his skin. But of course, she did no such thing. She breathed in deeply. She regained her composure. The composure that had been ingrained since the day she was born. She would do the sensible thing. She knew that there was no point making a scene, demanding an explanation. Any sort of explanation that could cause even the tiniest scratch on their picture-perfect life. She folded the receipt carefully and tucked it back into its hiding place, willing it to disappear from his wallet and from her mind. Just disappear. Chapter 13. Philip and Eleanor Young. Sydney, Australia, and Singapore. Philip sat in his favorite metal folding chair on the dock that stretched out from his waterfront lawn, keeping one watchful eye on the fishing line that went straight into Watson's Bay and the other eye on the latest issue of Popular Mechanics. His cell phone began to vibrate in the pocket of his cargo pants, disrupting the serenity of his morning. He knew it would be his wife on the line. She was practically the only person who ever called his cell. Eleanor insisted that he keep the phone on his body at all times, in case she needed him in an emergency. Although he doubted he could be of any help since he spent much of the year here in Sydney, while she was constantly traveling between Singapore, Hong Kong, Bangkok, Shanghai, and God knows where else. He answered the phone, and immediately the hysterical torrent from his wife began.
"Calm down and speak slower, La. I can't understand a word you're saying," Philip asked in his usual laconic manner.
"I just got the dossier on Rachel Chu from that private investigator in Beverly Hills who Mabel Kwok recommended. Do you want to know what it says?"
It wasn't a question. It sounded like more of a threat.
Who is Rachel Chu?" Philip asked.
"Don't be so senile. Don't you remember what I told you last week? Your son has been dating some girl in secret for more than a year, and he had the cheek to tell us about it just days before he brings her to Singapore."
"You hired a private investigator to check up on this girl?"
"Of course I did. We know nothing about this girl, and everyone is already talking about her and Nikki."
Philip looked down at his fishing pole, which was beginning to vibrate a hair. He knew where this conversation was leading, and he wanted no part in it.
"I'm afraid I can't talk right now, darling. I'm in the middle of something urgent."
"Stop it, La. This is urgent. The report is even worse than my worst nightmare. Your stupid cousin Cassandra got it wrong. It turns out the girl is not one of the Chus from the Taipei Plastics family."
"I always tell you not to believe a word out of Cassandra's mouth, but what difference does it make?"
"What difference? This girl is being deceitful. She is pretending to be a Chu."
"Well, if her last name happens to be Chu, how can you accuse her of pretending to be a Chu?" Philip said with a chuckle.
"Don't contradict me. I'll tell you how she's being deceitful."
At first, the private investigator told me she was ABC, but then after more digging, he found out that she's not even truly American-born Chinese. She was born in mainland China and went to America when she was 6 months old.
So?
Did you hear me? Mainland China!
Philip was baffled.
Doesn't everybody's family ultimately originate from mainland China? Where would you rather her be from? Iceland?
Don't be funny with me! Her family comes from some Ulu village in China that nobody has ever heard of. The investigator thinks that they were most likely working class. In other words, they are peasants.
I think if you go back far enough, darling, all our families were peasants. We all came from remote villages. And don't you know that in ancient China, the peasant class was actually revered? They were the backbone of the economy and—
Stop talking nonsense, La! You haven't heard the worst yet. This girl came to America as a baby with her mother. But where's the father? There's no record of the father, so they must have divorced. Can you believe it? A la marca child from some divorced no-name Ulu family. I'm going to tell Lao.
Stop it, darling. You're not going to jump off a building. There are plenty of people these days who come from broken homes and go on to have happy marriages. Just look at the divorce rate here in Australia.
Philip was trying to reason with his wife. Eleanor sighed deeply.
These Aussies are all descended from criminals. What do you expect?
This is why you're so popular down here, darling, Philip joked.
You are not seeing the big picture. This girl is obviously a cunning, deceitful gold digger. You know as well as I do that your son can never marry someone like that. Can you imagine how your family is going to react when he brings this gold digger home?
Actually, I couldn't care less what they think.
But don't you see how this will affect Nikki? And of course, your mother is going to blame me for this, La. I always get blamed for everything. Ah, Lamak, surely you know how this will end.
Philip sighed deeply. This was the reason he spent as much time as he possibly could away from Singapore.
I've already asked Lorena Lim to use all her Beijing contacts to investigate the girl's family in China. We need to know everything. I don't want to leave a single stone unturned. We need to be prepared for every possibility, Eleanor said.
Don't you think you're going a bit overboard?
Absolutely not. We must put a stop to all this nonsense before it goes any further. Do you want to know what Daisy Fu thinks?
Not really.
Daisy thinks that Nikki is going to propose to the girl while they're in Singapore.
If he hasn't already, Philip teased.
Alamak, do you know something I don't? Has Nikki told you?
No, don't panic. Darling, you are letting your silly girlfriends work you up for nothing. You just need to trust our son's good judgment. I'm sure this girl is going to turn out just fine.
The fish was really tugging at the line now. Maybe it was a barramundi. He could ask his chef to grill it for lunch. Philip just wanted to get off the phone. That Thursday, at Carol Tai's Bible study, Eleanor decided that it was time to call in her ground troops. As the ladies sat around enjoying homemade bobo cha-cha and helping Carol organize her collection of Tahitian black pearls by color grade, Eleanor began her lament as she savored her chilled coconut and sago pudding.
Nikki doesn't realize what a terrible thing he is doing to us. Now he tells me he's not even going to stay at our new flat when he arrives. He's going to stay at Kingsford Hotel with that girl, as if he needs to hide her from us. Alamak, how is this going to look?
Eleanor sighed dramatically.
So disgraceful. Sharing a hotel room when they aren't even married. You know, some people might think they eloped and are coming here for their honeymoon.
Nadine Shaw chimed in, though secretly the thought of any potential scandal that might bring those high and mighty youngs down a peg filled her with glee. She continued to fan Eleanor's flames, not that they needed any further stoking.
How dare this girl think she can just waltz right into Singapore on Nikki's arm and attend the social event of the year without your approval? She obviously has no clue how things work here. Ayah, children these days don't know how to behave, Daisy Fu said quietly, shaking her head. My sons are just the same.
You're lucky that Nicky even told you he was bringing someone home. I would never be able to expect that from my boys. I have to find out in the newspapers what they're doing. What to do, La? This is what happens when you educate your children overseas. They become too westernized and oxyborak when they return. They think they know it all. Can you imagine? My daughter-in-law Danielle forces me to make an appointment 2 weeks in advance just to see my grandchildren. She thinks that because she graduated from Amherst, she knows better than me how to raise my own grandchildren. Better than you? Everyone knows these ABCs are descended from all the peasants that were too stupid to survive in China, Nadine cackled. Hey, Nadine, don't underestimate them. These ABC girls can be Xin Lihai. They are very sharp, Lorena Lim warned. Now that America is broke, all these ABCs want to come to Asia and sink their claws into our men. They are even worse than the Taiwanese tornadoes because they are westernized, sophisticated, and worst of all, college-educated. Do you remember Mrs. Shu Zhenta's son? That Ivy League-degreed ex-wife of his purposely introduced him to the girl who would become his mistress and then used that silly excuse to get a huge divorce settlement. The Shus had to sell so many properties just to pay her off. So sayang, such a waste. My Danielle was so quiet at first, so dutiful and modest, Daisy recalled. Hiya, the minute that 30-carat diamond was on her finger, she transformed into the bloody queen of Sheba. Nowadays, she wears nothing but Prada, Prada, Prada. And have you seen how she makes my son waste money by hiring that whole security team to escort her everywhere she goes, as if she is some big shot? Who wants to kidnap her? My son and my grandchildren are the ones who should have the bodyguards, not this girl with the flat nose. Soy dosé, so atrocious, I could die. I don't know what I would do if my son brought home a girl like that. Eleanor moaned and put on her saddest expression. Come, come, Lele, have some more bobo cha-cha, Carol said, trying to soothe her friend as she ladled more of the fragrant dessert into Eleanor's bowl. Nicky is a good boy. You should thank the Lord that he isn't like my Bernard. I gave up trying to get Bernard to listen to me long ago. His father lets him get away with everything. What to do? His father just pays and pays while I just pray and pray. The Bible tells us we must accept what we cannot change. Lorena looked at Eleanor, wondering whether this was the right time to drop her bombshell. She decided to go for it. Eleanor, you asked me to do a little investigating for you about this true girl's family in China. And I don't want you to get too excited, but I've just received the most intriguing tidbit. So fast? What did you find out? Eleanor perked up. Well, there's a fellow who claims to have very valuable info on Rachel, Lorena continued. A la mark, what? What? Eleanor asked, getting alarmed. I don't know exactly, but it comes from a source in Shenzhen, Lorena said. Shenzhen? Do they say what kind of information? Well, they just said it was very valuable, and they won't talk over the phone. They will only give you the information in person, and it's going to cost you. How did you find these people? Eleanor asked excitedly. Wa u kang to ma, Lorena said mysteriously. I think you should go to Shenzhen next week. You and your secret contacts. You know I can't go away next week. Nicky and that girl will be here, Eleanor replied. Elle, I think you should go precisely when Nicky and that girl arrive, Daisy suggested. Think about it. They are not even staying with you, so you have the perfect excuse not to be here. And if you are not here, you have all the advantage. You will show everyone that you are not rolling out the red carpet for this girl, and you won't lose face if she turns out to be a total nightmare. Plus, you'll have gained some vital new information, Nadine added. Maybe she's already married. Maybe she already has a child. Maybe she's running some huge scam and I need a Xanax, Eleanor cried, reaching into her purse. Lorena, stop scaring Lily, Carol interjected.
We don't know this girl's story. Maybe it's nothing at all. Maybe God will bless Eleanor with a dutiful, God-fearing daughter-in-law. Judge not, lest ye be judged. Matthew 7:1.
Eleanor considered everything that her friends had to say.
Daisy, you're always so smart. Lorena, can I stay at your beautiful flat in Shenzhen?
Of course. I was going to come with you. Also, I've been dying to go on another shopping marathon in Shenzhen.
Who else wants to come to Shenzhen this weekend? Carol, are you in?
Eleanor asked, hoping that Carol could be roped in and they would get to use her plane. Carol leaned over from her bed and said,
I'll check, but I think we can take the plane if we leave before the weekend. I know my husband has to fly to Beijing to take over some internet company called Alibaba earlier in the week, and Bernard's using the plane for Colin Koo's bachelor party on Saturday.
Let's all go to Shenzhen for a ladies' spa weekend, Nadine declared. I want to go to that place where they soak your feet in those wooden buckets and then massage them for an hour.
Eleanor was beginning to get excited.
This is a good plan. Let's go shop till we drop in Shenzhen. We'll let Nikki and this girl manage on their own, and then I will return with my valuable information.
Your valuable ammunition, Lorena corrected.
Ha ha, that's right,
Nadine cheered, digging into her handbag and beginning to text her stockbroker covertly.
Now, Carol, what was the name of that internet company the Dato is planning to take over?
Chapter 14. Rachel and Nicholas. Singapore. The plane banked sharply to the left, breaking out of the clouds as Rachel caught sight of the island for the first time. They had departed New York 21 hours ago, and after one refueling stop in Frankfurt, she was in Southeast Asia now, in the realm her ancestors called the Nanyang, the Southern Sea. But the view she could glimpse from the plane did not resemble some romantic terrain swathed in mist. Rather, it was a dense metropolis of skyscrapers glittering in the evening sky. And from 6,000 feet, Rachel could already feel the pulsating energy that was one of the world's financial powerhouses. As the electronic doors of the customs area slid open to reveal the tropical oasis that was the arrival hall of Terminal 3, the first thing Nick saw was his friend Colin Koo, holding up a large placard with Best Man printed on it. Beside him stood an exceedingly tan, willowy girl, clutching a bunch of silver balloons. Nick and Rachel rolled their luggage carts toward them.
What are you doing here?
Nick exclaimed in surprise as Colin squeezed him into a bear hug.
Come on! Of course I had to welcome my best man properly. This is full service, man!
Colin beamed.
My turn!
The girl beside him declared, leaning over and giving Nick a hug, followed by a quick peck on the cheek. She turned next to Rachel, stretched out her hand, and said,
You must be Rachel. I'm Araminta.
Oh, sorry. Let me make proper introductions. Rachel Chu, meet Araminta Lee, Colin's fiancé, and this, of course, is Colin Koo, Nick said.
So nice to finally meet you, Rachel smiled, shaking their hands vigorously. She wasn't prepared for this welcoming party, and after all those hours on the plane, she could only imagine how she must look. She studied the cheery couple for a bit. People always look so different from their pictures. Colin was taller than she imagined, roguishly handsome, with dark freckles and an unruly shock of hair that made him look a bit like a Polynesian surfer. Behind her wire-framed spectacles, Araminta had a very pretty face, even without a stitch of makeup. Her long black hair was pulled into a rubber-banded ponytail that reached down to the small of her back, and she looked far too skinny for her tall frame. She was wearing what appeared to be a pair of plaid pajama pants, a pale orange tank top, and flip-flops. Though she was probably in her mid-20s, she looked more like a schoolgirl than someone about to walk down the aisle. They were an unusually exotic couple, and Rachel wondered how their children might end up looking. Colin began texting away on his cell phone.
The drivers have been circling around for a while. Let me just make sure they know we're ready.
I can't believe this airport. It makes JFK look like Mogadishu, Rachel remarked. She stared up in wonder at the soaring ultra-modern structure, the indoor palm trees, and the immense lush vertical hanging garden that seemed to make up an entire length of the terminal. A fine mist of water began to spread over the cascading greenery. Are they misting the entire wall? I feel like I'm at some upscale tropical resort.
The whole country is an upscale tropical resort, Colin quipped as he led them toward the exit.